a discussion now of the enemy. After Pearl Harbor in December of 1941, every American knew exactly who the enemy was. Even still, President Roosevelt, in talking about it in one of his fireside chats, used the enemy by name.
Many rumors and reports, which we now hear, originate, of course, with enemy sources. For instance, today the Japanese are claiming that as a result of their one action against Hawaii, they have gained naval supremacy in the Pacific. The purposes of such fantastic claims are, of course, to spread fear and confusion among us and to goad us into revealing military information which our enemies are desperately anxious to obtain.
And of course, the enemy during the 50 years of the Cold War was precise. It was the Soviets. Is it precise here, with President Bush speaking after September 11th, 2001?
Our enemies believed America was weak and materialistic, that we would splinter in fear and selfishness. They were as wrong as they are evil.
They were, although not identified by name, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. But what do we make of President Obama, who used the word enemy only once in his third State of the Union address, even though there are two American wars underway in Afghanistan and Iraq?
No one rival superpower is aligned against us. And so we must defeat determined enemies wherever they are and build coalitions that cut across lines of region and race and religion.
Quite a transformation from Roosevelt there to Obama. Joining us now is Philip Gurevich, who is a writer and journalist and taking part in an upcoming event at the New York Public Library called The New Face of the Enemy. Philip, is there an intellectual as well as a nationalistic history of who the enemy is?
Well, my sense is that actually these definitions of the enemy have always been varying between very precise, when you know exactly who it is, when the Japanese attack you and it's a government attacking a government, and the kind of vague language that the war on terror or any kind of insurgency involves, where you're dealing with a non-state group or groups and you're having to go at it that way. And then, of course, you have all kinds of times when the enemy is redefined not as a military enemy, but as some group of people who, whether it's for an ethnic minority or a religious group or some other enemy in one's midst, who often is associated in some broad way with a larger enemy that's actually military, but that you focus on them instead to usually create a kind of unity on your side. So, I mean, an example I've written about the Rwandan genocide. In Rwanda, the Hutu majority was very splintered politically, and the extremist leaders wanted to mobilize them and unify them. And one of the best mechanisms for that always is to focus all their energy on a common enemy, the Tutsi minority in this case.
Right.
And there was a war going on, but instead of getting everybody to go up to the front and fight the actual armed enemy, the idea was to focus on the enemy in our midst and to create a kind of unity, which led to the genocide and actually makes you realize that genocide in a case like that is about building a community as well as about exterminating a community.
Well, you're describing two moving targets, the idea of who are the people who actually want to do something bad to you, and this other target that's an interior psychological domain, which is the ultimate fear that you have. You always sort of understand your greatest fear, and if somebody can put a face to that fear, all of a sudden you're signed up for potentially genocide. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, that's the most possibly extreme case, obviously. And I think that one can have all sorts of fear. I mean, I think in America there was a lot of fear after 2011 without any threat of genocide. But that one, you know, there's obviously been a big debate in America since 2011 as to whether our enemy is Al-Qaeda or radical Islam or the Muslim world or what did Obama call it? Determined enemies everywhere.
does that mean, determined enemies anywhere? People who are upset that we're still number one?
I think he doesn't want to name it. I think one of the interesting things in that speech is that the wars have been made almost invisible, right? They barely ranked a mention at the very end. And that to some extent in Afghanistan, we're saying we're leaving Iraq. And we say in Afghanistan, our position is not that we're fighting a war to conquer Afghanistan or to defeat the Afghanis. We're essentially saying we're your friends, and there are these other guys in your midst who are calling themselves our enemies, but they're your enemies too, and you should let us, you know, be your friends. We're not fighting this war as your enemies. So they're really trying to avoid that language, even though you can't really go out and have a war where you're killing lots of people that involves, you know, no enemy.
Well, it's an interesting set of narratives. In the Rwandan case, a precision about knowing the enemy produces horrible sort of brutality. But in the case of Afghanistan, an ambiguity about the enemy permits governments to sustain a conflict that might end otherwise.
Yes, and let me suggest yet another complication on this, which is I wrote about the Abu Ghraib abuses and the torture there, and I looked at some of the background to that, and there was one woman, Captain Carolyn Wood, who had come in from the Bagram Air Base, where she had presided over in Afghanistan during the first phase of the Afghan War, and there had been terrible abuses under her control at the prison there, and people had died under American interrogation. And now she comes towards Abu Ghraib, and she said, the environment in Iraq was challenging because the U.S. Training for interrogation was rooted in and geared toward a conventional Cold War threat and not toward the Arab mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you suddenly see this. You start hearing amongst these soldiers at Abu Ghraib that their enemy is kind of the Arab mind, right? Which becomes a completely different thing. And then that leads to the abuses we saw, to be very broad and general about it. What led to it was American policy. But you then see these photographs, the American soldiers and the abused prisoners. And I think one of the interesting things is that in our own minds, the question arose, who really is the enemy of what we most stand for here? What, those people who we're doing this to, or us doing it?
And in the pictures themselves, you have soldiers who were so frustrated about not knowing who the enemy was in their day-to-day operations, suddenly deciding it's this person here, so I'm going to humiliate them.
Yeah, but fascinatingly, for instance, in the case of the man in the famous photograph with the hood over his head,
right,
and several of the other more famously abused prisoners, after all of this abuse, suddenly somebody would come through from military intelligence and say, hey, wait a minute, it's the wrong guy. It's not who we thought it was, who we asked you to beat him up for. And then there are photographs of the soldiers sitting around having chicken and smoking cigarettes with the same guy. They'd become their favorite soldier. As soon as you called them off and said, look, that's not the enemy. That guy's fine. They said, well, you know, he's a decent guy. We'll treat him like anybody else.
Wow, that is fascinating. Philip Gurevich, writer and journalist and author. And if you're in New York on Saturday this week, Philip Gurevich will be part of a conversation at the New York Library, New York Public Library on 42nd Street, called The New Face of the Enemy. Philip, thanks so much.
Great talking to you.
And we would love to get your thoughts on the enemy, the creation of enemies, or what, how they shape our psyches. You can give us your thoughts on enemy, how they define us, at thetakeaway.org. You can also give us a call, of course. The number is 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.